three stocks might be a reasonable maximum. A $3,000 account could be confined to two equities. Keep things manageable. The more stocks you own, the harder it is to keep track of them. Even investors with portfolios over $1 million need not own more than 6 or 7 well-selected securities. How to spread your purchases over time. It's possible to spread your purchases out over a period of time. When I accumulated a position in Amgen in 1990 and 1991, I bought on numerous days. The buying was spread out, and add-on buys were only made when there was a significant gain on earlier buys. If the market price was 20 points over my average cost, and a new buy point occurred off a proper base, I bought more. However, newcomers should be extremely careful in trying this more risky, highly concentrated approach. You've got to do it right, and you positively have to sell or cut back if things don't work as expected. In a bull market, one way to maneuver your portfolio toward more concentrated positions is to follow up and make 1 or 2 smaller additional buys in stocks as soon as they have advanced 2% to 3% above your original or last purchase price. However, don't allow yourself to keep chasing the stock once it's extended too far past a correct buy point. This will also spare you the frustration of owning a stock that goes a lot higher but isn't doing your portfolio much good because you own fewer shares of it than you do of other, less successful issues. At the same time, sell and eliminate stocks that start to show losses before they become big losses. Using the follow-up purchasing procedure should keep more of your money in just a few of your best stock investments. No system is perfect, but this one is more realistic than a haphazardly diversified portfolio and has a better chance of achieving important results. Diversification is definitely sound, just don't overdo it. Always set a limit on how many stocks you will own, and stick to your rules. If you do decide to concentrate, should you invest for the long haul or trade more frequently? The answer is that the holding period, long or short, is not the main issue. What's critical is buying the right stock, the very best stock, at precisely the right time, then selling it whenever the market or your various sell rules tell you it's time to sell. The time between your buy and your sell could be either short or long. Let your rules and the market decide which one it is. If you do this, some of your winners will be held for 3 months, some for 6 months, and a few for 1, 2, 3 years or more. Most of your losses will be held for shorter periods, normally from a few weeks to 3 months. No well-run portfolio should ever have losses that have been carried 6 months or more. Keep your portfolio clean and in sync with the market. Remember, good gardeners always weed the flower patch and prune weak stems. One type of investing I have always discouraged people from doing is day trading, where you buy and sell a given stock on the same day. Most investors lose money doing this. The reason is simple. You're predominantly dealing with minor daily fluctuations that are harder to read than basic trends over a longer time period. Besides, there's generally not enough profit potential in day trading to offset the commissions you generate and the losses that inevitably must occur. Don't try to make money so fast. Rome wasn't built in a day. There is a new form of day trading that is more like short-term swing trading, buying a stock on the upswing and selling before an inevitable pullback. It involves buying a stock at its exact pivot buy point off a chart, coming out of a base or price consolidation area, and selling it 5 or so days later after the breakout. Sometimes pivot points off of patterns such as the cup with handle pattern, identified on intraday charts of 5-minute intervals, can reveal a stock breaking out from an intraday pattern. If done with real skill, this can work for some people, but it requires a lot of time, study, and experience. Should you use margin? In the first year or two, while you're still learning to invest, it's much safer to operate on a cash basis. It usually takes most new investors at least 2 to 3 years to fully gain enough market experience, make several bad decisions, waste time trying to reinvent the wheel, and experiment with unsound beliefs before they are able to make and keep substantial profits. With a few years' experience, a sound plan, and a strict set of both buy and sell rules, you might consider buying on margin, using borrowed money from your brokerage firm in order to purchase more stock. Generally, margin buying should be done by younger investors who are still working. Their risk is somewhat less, because they have more time to prepare for retirement. The best time to use margin is usually during the first 2 years of a new bull market. Once you recognize a new bear market, you should get off margin immediately and raise as much cash as possible. You must understand that when the general market declines and your stocks start sinking, you will lose your initial capital twice as fast if you're fully margined than you would if you were invested on a cash basis. This dictates that you absolutely must cut all losses quickly and get off margin when major general market deterioration begins. If you speculate in small capitalization or high-tech stocks, fully margined, a 50% correction can cause a total loss. This happened to some new investors in 2000 and early 2001. You don't have to be fully margined all the time. Sometimes you'll have large cash reserves and no margin. At other times, you'll be invested on a cash basis. At still other points, you'll be using a small part of your margin buying power. And in a few instances, when you're making genuine progress in a bull market, you may be fully invested on margin. All of this depends upon the current market situation and your level of experience. I have always used margin and believe it offers a real advantage to an experienced investor who knows how to confine his or her buying to quality market leaders and who has the discipline and common sense to always cut losses short, with no exceptions. Your margin interest expense, depending on laws that change constantly, might be tax-deductible. However, in certain periods, margin interest rates can become so high that the probability of substantial success may be limited. If a stock in your margin account collapses in value to a point where your stockbroker asks you to put up money or sell stock, don't put up money. Think about selling stock. 9 times out of 10, you'll be better off. The marketplace is telling you that you're on the wrong path, you're getting hurt, and things aren't working. So sell and cut back your risk level. Again, why put good money after bad? To buy on margin, you'll need to sign a margin agreement with your broker and have your stock certificates held in Street, the brokerage company's name. As long as you're dealing with an established New York Stock Exchange firm, this should not create risk for you. In fact, having stock held in Street cuts down on the time and paperwork involved in keeping up with stock certificates, dividends, and splits, and it is more common now than ever. In fact, most investors do not have their brokers issue actual stock certificates anymore. This eliminates the time and trouble of taking securities back and forth to your broker each time you make a transaction, and it averts problems and notorious delays with transfer agents, whose job it is to collect, register, transfer, and mail certificates. The itemized account statements that most brokers provide each month are enough for most investors, since they serve as complete records for tax purposes. Should you sell short? I did some research on short selling and wrote a booklet in 1976, now out of print, but not much has changed on the subject since then. It's still a topic few investors understand, and an endeavor at which even fewer succeed, so consider carefully whether it's right for you. More active and seasoned investors might consider limited short selling. However, short selling is far more complicated than simply buying stocks, and most short sellers are run in and lose money. What is short selling? Think of short selling as reversing the normal buy and sell process. In short selling, you sell the stock instead of buy it, even though you don't own it, and therefore must borrow it from your broker, in the hope that it will go down in price instead of up. If the stock falls in price as you expect, you can cover your short position by buying it in the open market at a lower price and pocket the difference as your profit. You would sell short if you think the market is going to drop substantially or that a certain stock is ready to cave in. You sell the stock first, hoping to buy it back later at a lower price. Sounds easy, right? Wrong. Short selling rarely works out well. Usually the stock you sell short, expecting a colossal price decrease, will do the unexpected and begin to creep up in price. When it goes up, you lose money. Effective short selling is usually done at the beginning of a new general market decline. This means you have to short based on the behavior of the daily market averages. This, in turn, requires the ability to 1. Interpret the daily Dow, S&P 500, or NASDAQ indices, and 2. Select stocks that have had tremendous run-ups and have definitely topped out months earlier. In other words, your timing has to be flawless. You can be right, but if you're too early, you can be forced to cover at a loss. In selling short, you also have to minimize your risk by cutting your losses at 8%. Otherwise, the sky's the limit, and your stock could have an unlimited price increase. My first rule in short selling: don't sell short during a bull market. Why fight the overall tide? However, sooner or later you may disregard the advice in this book, try it for yourself, and find out the hard way. The same way one learns that wet paint signs usually mean what they say. Save the short selling for bear markets. Your odds will be a little better. The second rule is, never sell short a stock with a small number of shares outstanding. It's too easy for market makers and professionals to run up a thinly capitalized stock on you. This is called a short squeeze, meaning you could find yourself with a loss and be forced to sell. And it doesn't feel very good when you're in one. It's safer to short stocks trading an average daily volume of 5 to 10 million shares or more. Typically, short selling must be executed on an uptick from the previous trade. An uptick is any trade that is higher than the previous trade by at least a penny. Therefore, orders should normally be entered either at the market or at a maximum, with a limit of 25 cents or so below the last price. A weak stock could trade down a point or more without having an uptick. One alternative would be buying put options that don't need an uptick to receive an executed trade. You could also short tracking indices, like the QQQ NASDAQ 100, SMH Semiconductor Index, or BBH Biotech Index. These also do not require an uptick. Shorting is done in a margin account, so check with your broker to see if you can borrow the stock you want to sell short. Also, if the stock pays a dividend while you are short, you'll have to pay the dividend to the person who bought the stock you sold. Lesson: don't short big dividend-paying stocks. Short selling is treacherous even for professionals, and only the more able and daring should give it a try. One last warning: don't short an advancing stock just because its price seems too high. You could be taken to the cleaners. To summarize, diversification is good, but don't over-diversify. Concentrate on a smaller list of well-selected stocks, and let the market help determine how long each should be held. Using margin may be okay if you're experienced, but it involves significant extra risk. Lastly, don't sell short unless you know exactly what you're doing. Be sure to use charts for your timing. Chapter 12: How to Pick the Best Market Sectors, Industry Groups, and Subgroups. The majority of leading stocks are usually in leading industries. Studies show that 37% of a stock's price movement is directly tied to the performance of the industry group the stock is in. Another 12% is due to strength in its overall sector. Therefore, roughly half of a stock's move is due to the strength of its respective group. Because specific industry groups lead each market cycle, you can see how critical it is to consider a stock's industry group before making a purchase. For the purposes of this discussion, there are three terms we will use: sector, industry group, and subgroup. A sector is a broad grouping of companies and industries. These include, for example, basic industries, or cyclicals, consumer goods and services, transportation, finance, and high technology. An industry group is a smaller, more specific grouping of companies. You normally have several industry groups within one sector. A subgroup is even more specific, dividing the industry group into several very precise subcategories. For example, if we were to look at a company like Viacom, it could be described according to the following. Sector, leisure and entertainment. Industry group, media. Subgroup, radio, TV. For clarity and ease of use, industry group and subgroup names are combined into one description and simply called industry groups. For example, the industry group for Viacom is known as Media Radio TV. Why does IBD divide securities into 197 industry groups, rather than the 52 groups categorized, say, by Standard & Poor's? It's simple, really. All stocks in a given sector do not perform at the same rate. Within a given sector, even if the sector itself is outperforming other sectors, there may be segments of that sector that perform extremely well, and others that lag the market. It's important to be able to recognize what's acting better, since this knowledge can mean the difference between superior and mediocre results. Early on in our study of the market, we realized that many of the investment services available at the time did not adequately dissect the market into enough industry groups. It was therefore difficult to determine the specific part of a group where the true leadership was. So we created our own industry groups, breaking down the market into 197 different subcategories and providing investors with more detailed insights into the makeup of an industry. When analyzing industries, we've found some to be so small that signs of strength in the group might not be relevant. If only two small, thinly traded companies make up a sector, it may not be enough to call them a group. On the other hand, there are industries with too many companies, such as the chemical and savings and loan industries. This excessive supply does not add to their attractiveness, unless some extremely unusual changes occur in industry conditions. The 197 industry groups mentioned above can be found each business day in Investor's Business Daily. There we rank each group according to its six-month price performance, so that you can easily determine which industries are the true leaders. Buyers operating on the undervalued philosophy love to do their prospecting in the worst-ranked groups, but analysis has shown that, on average, stocks in the top 50 or 100 groups perform better than those in the bottom 100. To increase your odds of finding a truly outstanding stock in an outstanding industry, concentrate on the top 40 groups. Both the newspaper and the charting services offer an additional proprietary source of information to help determine if the stock you're thinking about buying is in a top industry group. Industry Group Relative Strength Rating assigns a letter grade from A+ to E to each publicly traded company that we follow, with A-plus being best. A stock with a rating of A-plus, A, or A-minus means it is in the top 24% of all industry groups in terms of price performance. Every day, I also quickly check the new price highs list in IBD. It is organized in order of the broad industry sectors with the most individual stocks that made new price highs the previous day. You can't find this list in other business publications. Just note the top 5 or 6 sectors. They are usually the true leaders. Another way to find out what industry groups are in or out of favor is to analyze the performance of a mutual fund family's industry funds. Fidelity Investments, one of the nation's successful mutual fund managers, has more than 35 industry mutual funds. A glance at their performance provides yet another good perspective on which industry sectors are doing better. For William O'Neill and Company institutional clients, a weekly datagraph service is provided that arranges 197 industry groups in order of their group relative price strength for the past 6 months. Stocks in the strongest categories are shown in Volume 1 of the O'Neill database books, and stocks in the weaker groups are in Volume 2. The importance of following industry trends. If economic conditions in 1970 told you to look for an improvement in housing and a big upturn in building, what stocks would have been included in your definition of the building sector? If you acquired a list of them, you'd find that there were hundreds of companies in that sector at the time. So how do you narrow down your choices to the ones that are performing best? The answer? Look at them from the industry group and subgroup levels. There were actually 10 industry groups within the building sector for investors to consider during the 1971 bull market. That meant 10 different ways you could have played the building boom. Many institutions bought stocks ranging from lumber producer Georgia Pacific to wallboard leader U.S. Gypsum to building products giant Armstrong Corporation. You could have also gone with Masco in the plumbing group, a home builder like Kaufman and Broad, building material retailers and wholesalers like Standard Brands Paint and Scotty's Home Builders, or mortgage insurers like MGIC. Then there were manufacturers of mobile homes and other low-cost housing, suppliers of air conditioning systems, and makers and sellers of furniture and carpets. Do you know where the traditional building stocks were during 1971? They spent the year in the bottom half of all industry groups, while newer, building-related subgroups in better-performing industry groups more than tripled. On August 14, 1970, the Mobile Home Group crossed into the top 100 industry groups and stayed there until February 12, 1971. The group returned to the top 100 on May 14, 1971, and then fell into the bottom half again on July 28, 1972. In the prior cycle, mobile homes were in the top 100 groups in December 1967 and dropped to the bottom half in 1969. The price advances of mobile home stocks were spellbinding during these positive periods. From 1978 to 1981, the computer industry was one of the leading sectors. Traditionally, money managers then thought of the industry as consisting of IBM, Burroughs, Sperry Rand, and the like. But these were all large mainframe computer manufacturers, and they failed to perform during that cycle. Why? Because while the computer sector was hot, some industry groups within it, like mainframe computers, were not. Meanwhile, the computer sector's many other subdivisions performed unbelievably. During that period, you could have selected stocks from groups such as Mini Computers, Prime Computer, Microcomputers, Commodore International, Graphics, Computer Vision, Word Processors, Wang Labs, Peripherals, Verbatim, Software, Cullinane Database, or Timesharing, Electronic Data Systems. These winners increased 5 to 10 times in price. During 1998 and 1999, the computer sector again led, with 50 to 75 computer-related stocks making Investors Business Daily's new high list almost daily. However, it was Siebel Systems, Oracle, and Veritas in the Enterprise Software Group, and Brocade and Emulex, local network stocks, that provided leadership. The Computer Internet Group boomed with Cisco, Juniper, and BEA systems, and EMC and Network Appliance in the Memory Group had enormous runs, while the former leading Personal Computers Group lagged in 1999. After their tremendous increases, most of these leaders then topped in 2000. Many new subgroups have sprung up since then, and many more will spring up in the future as new technologies are dreamed up and applied. We are in the computer, communications, and space age. New inventions and technologies will spawn thousands of new and superior products and services. We are benefiting from an endless stream of ingenious offshoots from the original mainframe industry, and in the past, they came so fast we had to more frequently update the various industry categories in our database just to keep up with it. Grouping and tracking stocks by industry group can also help get you out of weakening investments faster. If, after a successful run, one or two important stocks in a group break seriously, the weakness may sooner or later wash over into the remaining stocks in that field. For example, in February 1973, weakness in some key building stocks suggested that even stalwarts such as Kaufman and Broad and MGIC were vulnerable, despite the fact that they were holding up well. At the time, fundamental research firms were in unanimous agreement about MGIC, They were sure the mortgage insurer had earnings gains of 50% locked in for the next 2 years, and that the company would continue along its merry course, unaffected by the building cycle. The analysts were wrong. MGIC later collapsed, along with the rest of the deteriorating group. In the same month, ITT traded between $50 and $60, while every other stock in the conglomerate group had been in a long decline. The two central points overlooked by four leading research firms that recommended ITT in 1973 were that the group was very weak, and ITT's relative strength was trending lower, even though the stock itself was not. Sometimes a major development happens in one industry, and related industries later reap follow-on benefits. For example, in the late 1960s, the airline industry underwent a renaissance with the introduction of jet airplanes, causing airline stocks to soar. The increase in air travel a few years later spilled over to the hotel industry, which was more than happy to expand to meet the rising number of travelers. Beginning in 1967, hotel stocks enjoyed a tremendous run. Lowe's and Hilton were especially big winners. The follow-on effect, in this case, was that increased air travel created a shortage of hotel space. When the price of oil grew dear in the late 1970s, oil companies began drilling like mad for the suddenly pricey commodity. As a result, higher oil prices fueled a surge not only in oil stocks in 1979, but also in the stocks of oil service companies that supplied the industry with exploration equipment and services. The roaring success of small and medium-sized computer manufacturers during the 1978 to 1981 bull market created follow-on demand for computer services, software, and peripheral products in the market resurgence of late 1982. As the Internet took off in the mid-1990s, people discovered an insatiable demand for faster access and greater bandwidth. Soon, networking stocks surged, with companies specializing in fiber optics enjoying massive gains in their share prices. The cousin stock theory. If a group is doing exceptionally well, there may be a supplier company, a cousin stock, that's also benefiting. As airline demand grew in the mid-1960s, Boeing was selling many new jets. Every new Boeing jet was outfitted with chemical toilets, made by a company called Monogram Industries. Amid earnings growth of 200%, Monogram stock had a 1,000% advance. In 1983, Fleetwood Enterprises, a leading manufacturer of recreational vehicles, was a big winner in the stock market. Textone was a small cousin stock that supplied vinyl-clad paneling and hollow-core cabinet doors to RV and mobile home companies. If you notice a company that's doing particularly well, research it thoroughly. In the process, you may discover a supplier company also worth investing in. Most group moves occur because of substantial changes in industry conditions. In 1953, aluminum and building stocks had a powerful bull market due to pent-up demand for housing in the aftermath of war. Wallboard was in such short supply that some builders offered new Cadillacs to gypsum board salespeople just to buy a carload of their product. In 1965, the onrush of a Vietnam War that was to cost $20 billion or more created solid demand for electronics used in military applications and defense during the war. Companies such as Fairchild Camera climbed more than 200% in price. In the 1990s, discount brokerage firms continued to gain market share versus full-service firms as investing became more and more mainstream. Charles Schwab, one of the most successful discount brokerage firms, performed as well as market leader Microsoft during this time. In our database research, we also pay attention to areas of the country where corporations are located. In our ratings of companies as far back as 1971, we assigned extra points for those headquartered in Dallas, Texas, and other key growth or technology centers, such as California's Silicon Valley. Shrewd investors should also be aware of demographic trends. From data such as the number of people in various age groups, it's possible to predict potential growth for certain industries. The surge of women into the workplace and the gush of baby boomers help explain why stocks like The Limited, Dress Barn, and other retailers of women's apparel soared between 1982 and 1986. It also pays to understand the basic nature of key industries. For example, high-tech stocks are 2.5 times as volatile as consumer stocks, so if you don't buy right, you can suffer larger losses. Or, if you concentrate most of your portfolio in them, they could all come down at the same time. So be aware of your risk exposure if you get over-concentrated in the volatile high-tech sector. It's also important for investors to know which groups are defensive in nature. If, after a couple of bull market years, you see buying in groups such as gold, silver, tobacco, food, grocery, and electric and telephone utilities, you may be approaching a top. Prolonged weakness in the utility average could also be signaling higher interest rates and a bear market ahead. The gold group moved into the top half of all 197 industries on February 22, 1973. Anyone ferreting out such information got the first crystal-clear warning at that time of one of the worst market upheavals since 1929. Of the most successful stocks from 1953 through 1993, nearly 2 out of 3 were part of group advances. So remember the importance of staying on top of your research and being aware of new group movements cannot be overestimated. Chapter 13. How you could make $1 million owning mutual funds. A mutual fund is a diversified portfolio of stocks managed by a professional investment company, usually for a small management fee. Investors purchase shares in the fund itself and make or lose money based on the combined profits and losses of the stocks within the fund. What you're buying when you purchase a mutual fund is professional management to make decisions for you in the stock market. You should handle a mutual fund differently from the way you handle individual stocks. A stock may decline and never come back in price. That's why you always need a loss-cutting policy. In contrast, a well-selected, diversified, domestic growth stock fund run by an established management organization will, in time, always recover from the steep corrections that naturally occur during bear markets. The reason they come back is that mutual funds are broadly diversified and generally participate in each recovery cycle in the U.S. economy. Mutual funds are outstanding investment vehicles if you learn how to use them correctly. However, many investors don't understand how to manage them to their advantage. The first thing to understand is that the big money in mutual funds is made by owning them through several business cycles, market ups and downs. This means 10, 15, or 20 years or longer. To sit tight for that long requires patience and confidence. It's like real estate. If you buy a house and then get nervous, selling out after only 3 or 4 years, you may not make anything. It takes time for your property to appreciate. Here's how I believe you, as a shrewd fund investor, should plan and invest. Pick a diversified domestic growth fund that performed in the top quartile of all mutual funds over the last 3 or 5 years. It will probably have averaged an annual rate of return of about 20%. The fund should also have outperformed many other domestic growth stock funds in the latest 12 months. You'll want to consult a reliable source for this information. Many investment-related magazines survey fund performances every quarter. Your stockbroker or library should have special fund performance rating services such as Weisenberger Thompson Financial or Lipper Incorporated, so you can get an unbiased review of the fund you're interested in purchasing. Investors Business Daily also rates mutual funds based on their 36-month performance records, on a scale from A-plus to E, as well as other performance percentages based on different time periods. Focus your research on mutual funds with an A-plus or A performance rating in IBD. The fund you pick does not have to be in the top 3 or 4 in performance each year to give you an excellent profit over 10 to 15 years. You should also reinvest your dividends and capital gains distributions, profits derived from a mutual fund's sales of stocks and bonds, to benefit from compounding over the years. The way to make a fortune in mutual funds is through compounding. Compounding happens when your earnings themselves, the performance gains plus any dividends and reinvested capital, generate more earnings, allowing you to put ever greater sums to work. The more time that goes by, the more powerful compounding becomes. In order to get the most benefit from compounding, you'll need a carefully selected growth stock fund, and you'll need to stick with it over time. When is the best time to buy a fund? Any time is the best time. You'll never know when the perfect time is, and waiting will usually result in paying a higher price. You should focus on getting started and building capital that will compound over the years. How many funds should you own? As time passes, you may discover you'd like to develop an additional long-term program. If so, do it. In 10 or 15 years, you might have hefty amounts in 2 or even 3 funds, but don't overdo it. There's no reason to diversify broadly in mutual funds. Individuals with multi-million-dollar portfolios could spread out somewhat further, allowing them to place sums into a more diverse group of funds. If this is to be done correctly, some attempt should be made to own funds with different management styles. For example, money may be divvied up among a value-type growth fund, an aggressive growth fund, a mid-to-large-cap growth fund, small-cap fund, etc. Many fund organizations, including Fidelity, Franklin Templeton, MFS Funds, Nicholas Applegate, Strong Funds, AIM, Scudder, American Century, Oppenheimer, Dreyfus, Vanguard Group, IDS Mutual, and others, offer families of funds with varied objectives. In most cases, you have the right to switch to any other fund in the family at a nominal transfer fee. These families could offer you the added flexibility of making prudent changes many years later. Don't let the market diminish your long-term resolve. Bear markets can last from 6 months to, in some rare cases, 2 years or more. If you're going to be a successful long-term investor in mutual funds, you'll need courage and perspective to live through many discouraging bear markets. Have the vision to build yourself a great long-term growth program and stick to it. Each time the economy goes into a recession and the newspapers and TV are saying how terrible things are, consider adding to your fund when it's 30% or more off its peak. You might go so far as to borrow a little money to buy more if you feel a bear market has ended. If you're patient, the price should be up nicely in 2 or 3 years. Growth funds that invest in more aggressive stocks should go up more than the general market in bull phases, but they will also decline more in bear markets. Don't be alarmed. Instead, try to look ahead several years. Daylight follows darkness. You may think that buying mutual funds during periods like the Great Depression would be a bad idea because it would take 30 years to break even. However, on an inflation-adjusted basis, had investors bought at the top of 1929, they would have broken even in just 14 years, based on the performance of the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Had these investors bought at the top of the market in 1973, they would have broken even in just 11 years. If, in addition, they had dollar-cost averaged throughout these bad periods, meaning they had purchased additional shares as the price went down, lowering their overall cost per share, investors would have broken even in half the time. Even during the worst 2 market periods in history, growth funds did bounce back, and did so in less time than you'd expect. In other words, if you took the absolutely worst period of the 20th century, the Great Depression, and you bought at the top of the market, then dollar cost averaged down, at worst, it would have taken 7 years to break even. This is compelling evidence that dollar-cost averaging into mutual funds and holding them for the long haul is smart investing. Some may find this confusing, since we tell people never to dollar-cost average down in stocks. The difference is that a stock can go to zero, while a domestic, widely diversified, professionally managed mutual fund will find its way back when the market gets better, often tracking near the performance of benchmarks like the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average. The super big gains from mutual funds come from compounding over a span of many years. Funds should be an investment for as long as you live. They say diamonds are forever. Well, so are your funds. So buy right and sit tight. The five most common mistakes mutual fund investors make. 1. Failing to sit tight for at least 10 to 15 years. 2. Worrying about a fund's management fee, turnover rate, or the dividends it pays. 3. Being affected by news in the market when you're supposed to be investing for the long term. 4. Selling out during bad markets. 5. Being impatient and losing confidence too soon. Other common mistakes. Typical investors in mutual funds tend to buy the best performing fund after it's had a big year. What they don't realize is that history virtually dictates that the next year or two will probably show much slower results. If the economy goes into a recession, the results could be poorer still. Such conditions are usually enough to scare out those with less conviction and those who want to get rich quick. Some investors switch, usually at the wrong time, to another fund that someone convinces them is much safer or has a hotter recent performance record. Switching may be okay if you have a really bad fund or the wrong type of fund, but too much switching quickly destroys what must be a long-term commitment to the benefits of compounding. America's long-term future has always been a shrewd investment. The U.S. stock market has been growing since 1790, and the country will continue to grow in the future in spite of wars, panics, and recessions. Investing in mutual funds the right way is one way to benefit from America's growth and to secure your and your family's long-term financial future. Chapter 14. Important Guidelines to Remember. 1. Don't buy cheap stocks. Buy NASDAQ stocks mainly selling between $15 and $300 a share, and New York Stock Exchange stocks from $20 to $300 a share. Avoid the junk pile. 2. Buy growth stocks that show each of the last 3 years' annual earnings per share up at least 25%, and the next year's consensus earnings estimate up 25% or more. Most growth stocks should also have annual cash flow of 20% or more above EPS. 3. Make sure the last 2 or 3 quarters' earnings per share are up a huge amount. Look for a minimum of 25% to 30%. In bull markets, look for EPS up 40% to 500%. The higher the better. 4. See that each of the last 3 quarters' sales are accelerating in their percentage increases, or the last quarter's sales are up at least 25%. 5. Buy stocks with a return on equity of 17% or more. The best companies will show a return on equity of 25% to 50%. 6. Make sure the recent quarterly after-tax profit margins are improving and near the stock's peak after-tax margins. 7. Most stocks should be in the top 5 or 6 broad industry sectors in IBD's daily new price highs list, or in the top 20% of IBD's 197 industry group rankings. 8. Don't buy a stock because of its dividend or PE ratio. Buy it because it's the number one company in its particular field in terms of earnings and sales growth, ROE, profit margins, and product superiority. 9. Buy stocks with a relative price strength rating of 85 or higher in Investors Business Daily's Smart Select ratings. 10. Any size capitalization will do, but the majority of your stocks should trade an average daily volume of several hundred thousand shares or more. 11. Learn to read charts and recognize proper bases and exact buy points. Use daily and weekly charts to materially improve your stock selection and timing. Buy stocks as they initially break out of sound and proper bases, with volume for the day 50% or more above normal trading volume. 12. Carefully average up, not down, and cut every single loss when it is 7% or 8% below your purchase price, with absolutely no exceptions. 13. Write out your sell rules that show when you will sell and nail down a profit in your stock. 14. Make sure your stock has at least one or two better-performing mutual funds who have bought it in the last reporting period. You want your stocks to have increasing institutional sponsorship over the last several quarters. 15. The company should have an excellent new product or service that is selling well. It should also have a big market for its product and the opportunity for repeat sales. 16. The general market should be in an uptrend and either favoring small or big cap companies. If you don't know how to interpret the general market, read IBD's The Big Picture column every day. 17. Don't mess around with options, stocks trading in foreign markets, bonds, preferred stocks, or commodities. It doesn't pay to be a jack of all trades or to over-diversify or over-asset allocate. Either avoid options outright or restrict them to 5% or 10% of your portfolio. 18. The stock should have ownership by top management. 19. Look for a New America entrepreneurial company, a new issue within the last 7 or 8 years, rather than laggard old America companies. 20. Forget your pride and ego. The market doesn't know or care what you think. No matter how smart you think you are, the market is always smarter. A high IQ and a master's degree are not guarantees of market success. Your ego could cost you a lot of money. Don't argue with the market, and never try to prove you're right and the market is wrong. 21. Read Investor's Corner and The Big Picture in IBD Daily. Learn how to recognize general market tops and bottoms. Read up on any company you own or plan to buy. Learn its story. 22. Watch for companies that have recently announced they are buying back 5% to 10% or more of their common stock. Find out if there is new management in the company and where it came from. 23. Don't try to buy a stock at the bottom or on the way down in price, and don't average down. If you buy at $40, don't buy more if it goes down to $35 or $30. Key reasons people miss buying big winning stocks. 1. Disbelief, fear, and lack of knowledge. Most big winners are newer companies, IPOs in the last 7 or 8 years. Everyone knows Sears and General Motors, but most people are simply unaware or unfamiliar with the hundreds of new names coming into the market every year. The new America names are the growth engine of America, creating innovative new products and services, plus most of the new technology. A chart service is one easy way to at least be aware of the basics of price, volume, sales, and earnings trends of all these younger companies. 2. P.E. bias. Contrary to conventional wisdom, the best stocks rarely sell at low P.E.s. Just like the best ball players make the highest salaries, the better companies sell at better, higher P.E.s. Using P.E.s as a selection criteria will prevent you from buying many of the best stocks. 3. Not understanding that the real leaders start their big moves by selling near or at new price highs, not near new lows or off a good amount from their highs. Investors like to buy stocks that look cheap because the stocks are lower than they were a few months ago, so they buy stocks on the way down. They think they are getting bargains. They should be buying stocks on the way up, just making new price highs as they are breaking out of a base or price consolidation area. 4. Selling too soon, either because they get shaken out or they are too quick to take a profit and psychologically having a hard time buying back the stock. They also sell too late, letting a small loss turn into a devastating one by not cutting all their losses at 8%. One final thought. You could definitely become a millionaire once you learn to save and invest properly. My parting advice, have courage, be positive, and don't ever give up. Great opportunities occur every year in America. Get prepared, study, learn, and go for them. What you'll find is that little acorns can grow into giant oaks, and that with persistence and hard work, anything is possible. You can do it, and your own determination to succeed is the most important element. We at Investors Business Daily, Investors.com, and Daily Graphs Online are here to help you every step of the way, and we look forward to hearing your success stories. Please email or write us, letting us know how you're doing with the CAN-SLIM system. And of course, we're here to answer any questions you might have along the way. This is Chris Ryan for McGraw-Hill Audio. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is co-published by American Media International and Redwood Audiobooks and is based upon the book entitled How to Make Money in Stocks by William J. O'Neill, copyrighted in 2002 in the name of William J. O'Neill and copyrighted in 1995, 1991, 1988 by McGraw-Hill Incorporated. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with the McGraw-Hill Companies, Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.